However, he grew jaded. He no longer found satisfaction in proving that a politician had taken a payoff from a Saudi prince, or by forging historical documents that appeared to convict a candidate's father of serving as a Grand Kleagle in the Ku Klux Klan, and of having fed people of color to a wood chipper. His boredom metastasized into an ennui so profound he couldn't get out of bed some days, and his career seemed to be over. For men with his talents, however, unexpected opportunities arise. He now makes terrific money working for a man who calls himself Marshall Ackerman, which may or may not be his real name. Ackerman is employed by a nonprofit called Volunteers for a Better Tomorrow. Based on Jason Drucklow's careful research, Volunteers for a Better Tomorrow may or may not be run by surrogates of David James Michael. That discovery has both reassured Jason that he will always be paid, but also discouraged him from probing any further into the chain of command through which he receives his directions, lest he end up in a wood chipper, metaphorically speaking. This Friday morning, he receives an encrypted email from Ackerman, who wants him to ascertain, stat, the whereabouts of Randall Larkin, whose wife cannot reach him. Jason lives in and conducts business from a luxury apartment in a highly desirable building on Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills, not far from the offices of Woodbine, Kravitz, Larkin, and Benedetto. He does not pay rent. Neither does he have to spend his own money to acquire the computers, printers, scanners, and other state-of-the-art tech that outfits his home office. The first thing that Jason Allen Drucklow does from his primary computer is enter the National Security Agency's vast data empire by a back door that he has been assured is approved by the very highest officials of that agency, for whom Volunteers for a Better Tomorrow is a valued secret associate. In cities all over America, and not just in cities, traffic and venue cameras assist in preserving the security of the people, while providing a historical record of various activities. Jason accesses an NSA program that coordinates the video systems of nearly all law enforcement jurisdictions nationwide, making it possible to skip to any location coast to coast to obtain a real-time view of what might be occurring there. In about a minute and a half, he discovers that Beverly Hills maintains no traffic cam in the alleyway behind Randall Larkin's law offices. Fortunately, there are cameras on the parallel main streets connected by the alley, and video archives might show the attorney arriving at work earlier in the morning. Chapter 7. Randall Larkin, still unconscious, sat in one of the patio chairs, his hands no longer cuffed, his ankles no longer shackled. Each forearm was zip-tied to an arm of the chair, each ankle to one of the front legs, so that he could not stand. Jane waited in the second chair, facing her captive from a distance of about 8 feet. The Coleman lantern hissed softly as a steady mist of vaporized fuel escaped the valve into the incandescent fabric mantle. Head hung forward, breathing shallowly, Larkin regained consciousness slowly at first. He mumbled senseless syllables, a snail's trail of saliva ribboning from one corner of his mouth and dripping from his jaw onto a pant leg of his fine, medium-gray suit. Twice, he hummed, sang a few bars of a slurred version of a tune that she didn't recognize. His fingers stroked the aluminum arms of the chair as if the smooth texture appealed to him. After a while, he raised his head and opened his eyes and blinked in stupefaction. He squinted at the white-hot mantle of the lantern, and then noticed Jane. He frowned at her and smacked his lips and said, "Dream," before closing his eyes. A couple minutes later, when he raised his head and looked again, he knew he wasn't dreaming.
"You. Who are you?"
"Think about it," she suggested. When he tried to lift a hand to wipe the drool from his face, he seemed to realize for the first time that he was trammeled. He strained against the zip ties, tried to kick his feet, rattling the chair against the concrete floor. The stare he turned on her was sharper than before.
The alley. The girl in the alley. What are you doing here?
She spoke calmly, and as if she were concerned for him. Maybe you need to think about what you're doing here.
Do I know you? I don't know you.
You've never met me, but you know me.
What's this? A riddle? Don't riddle me. Why would you riddle me?
It's the wig you don't know, she explained patiently. The wig and the eyeshadow and the blue lipstick and the nose ring. He puzzled over that for a moment, and then his eyes widened with understanding. He had unusual light brown eyes, the color of khaki, with darker striations.
Jane Hawk, he said.
Ah, now you're almost back from the land of Nod. He tested his restraints again.
How did I get here? What did you do to me? I've got this weird, sweet taste in my mouth.
Chloroform. He worked his tongue tooth to tooth, thinking about the word.
You're out of your mind. You're batshit crazy.
She smiled and shook her head, not from my perspective.
This is kidnapping.
That's part of what it is.
You get life for kidnapping.
Don't worry about me, Randy. I'm already wanted for murder. He was fully back to being Randall Larkin. His eyes told the story of a sharp mind now quickening to every implication of his situation. He looked at the barrel base of the table, the bottles of water on the table, the dog dishes, the lantern and can of fuel. He stared up at the high windows so faintly limned by the morning sun. He turned his head, surveying the darkness pressing against the sphere of spectral light in which they, in their two facing chairs, seemed to float as though outside of space and time. Repeating the last words she had heard him speak to Lawrence Hannafin, Jane said, "Don't burn the toast." He was clueless for only a moment, and then realized that she'd heard their conversations.
Shit.
Pretty deep, too, she said sympathetically. Putting on his courtroom face, the fearless litigator cut her with a glare that must have intimidated countless witnesses in the throes of their testimony.
I'm not afraid of you.
I know, she said, but you will be.
You already know everything you need.
Not everything.
Even if you could crack me like an egg, and you can't, there's nothing I can tell you that you don't already know.
She watched him, but did not reply. The Coleman lantern hissed. After perhaps a minute, he said,
Sorry, but silence doesn't work with me.
I'm not working you with silence.
I'm just waiting for you to get to the next most obvious thing you're going to tell yourself to keep your shit together.
He pretended more interest in the factory than in her. He squinted into the surrounding gloom.
Where are we?
A place.
They'll find us.
I threw away your cell phone. Your Mercedes is already miles from here, rafting toward the ocean.
Rafting? What's that mean?
She shrugged. After another mutual silence, he said,
You didn't murder anyone. What I hear is the two you killed drew down on you first, self-defense.
There it is, she said. The next most obvious thing you're going to tell yourself to keep your shit together.
You're a rogue agent, you're ICE, but you're not capable of cold-blooded murder.
You think? He smiled a smile Da Vinci would never have cared to paint. Her next silence was watchful, and his was smug. Finally, he said,
The damn chloroform gave me a headache.
Good. The lantern hissed, as if light itself were deflating and eternal darkness would enshroud them when the hissing ceased. She said, "If I blow your brains out right now, even that wouldn't be murder. It would be self-defense. You know why?" He wouldn't play at first. He met her stare and waited. "Your associates threatened my little boy. Were you aware of that? They threatened to kill him. Kill him, but rape him first. They threatened to pack him off to ISIS or Boko Haram as a sex slave. In fact, pack us both off, me and him." She could see that he hadn't known, and that knowing had begun to change his calculations regarding her potential. "What designer suit is that?" she asked. Baffled by the change of subject, he said, "Suit? Is that a Brunello Cucinelli, like some of the suits in Larry Hannifin's closet?"
"What?"
"No." "Whose suit is it, then?"
"What does it matter? A suit.
Whose suit is it?
Why are you doing this?"
"I'm interested in everything about you, Randy. Whose suit is that?"
"It's just a suit."
Bolting up from the chair, she took a step toward him, her snarled shout ricocheting off the walls and through the raftered ceiling.
"What designer suit are you wearing, asshole?"
He flinched, disquieted, if not even alarmed, that her bottled rage should be uncorked over something as trivial as his suit.
"Xenia. Ermengildo Xenia, it's no big deal."
"How much did it cost?"
"The suit? I don't know. Maybe 4,000.
"Who made the tie?"
"The tie?"
She loomed over him, leaned toward him. She slapped his face once, twice, with all her strength, so hard her hands stung.
"Yeah, the freaking tie!"
He had so long been accustomed to wielding power that only now did he appear suddenly to understand that he could not rely on the decorum common to a courtroom. Nor could he shape the narrative with deceptively worded questions. She was asking the questions. He was the witness this time, she the litigator, and not just litigator, but also prosecutor.
"What did the freaking tie cost, Randy?"
He shrugged and pretended contemptuous indifference to her obsession with his wardrobe.
"Maybe a couple hundred."
"Tell me about the shirt." "You better know about the shirt." A double stutter on the P belied his composure.
"Paul Smith. Paul Smith, London."
"What's the story with the shoes?"
"Armando Cabral."
"You're quite a dandy, aren't you?"
"I dress well, that's all."
"Would you call that a power suit?"
"I wouldn't, no."
She said, "Given your current circumstances?" "Neither would I." She returned to her patio chair. She sat, watching him. He remained expressionless, but his eyes were windows on a cauldron of rage. In the chalky gaslight, Larkin's face lacked the ruddiness of raw anger, as pale now as salt flats in moonlight, the faintest dusting of gray under the lower eyelids, lips an anemic pink. He was furious. But he was also, at last, profoundly afraid. "Your current wife's name is Diamanta."
"Leave her out of this."
Jane raised her eyebrows.
"Why ever should I? You didn't leave my husband out of this." "She doesn't know anything."
"Oh, well, that's probably a lie." She cocked her head and regarded him quizzically, letting a half-smile come and go, as if she found him almost as amusing as he was repellent. "Your wife, Diamanta?" she said in a tone that might have been taken by the neighborhood gossip seeking a juicy morsel. "Does Diamanta know about Aspasia?" A moment of stunned silence revealed his shock before he said,
"Is that a drug or something? I don't do drugs."
He and the others in this conspiracy were aware that she had learned about the brain implants and the Hamlet list, that on the day of Bertold Schenck's death, she had taken possession of flash drives containing the scientist's research and also obtained ampules of the nanomachine control mechanisms suspended in a neutral medium and ready for injection. But they had no way of knowing that she had discovered the perverse and cruel other use to which they had put this fearsome technology. Aspasia. Randy, Randy, Randy. You know me a little better now. You know that I come well prepared to a conference like this. He said nothing. How often do you go to Aspasia, Randy? Once a month? Once a week? How extreme is your most extreme desire? She could read him. His pallid skin, eyes fever wet and sliding out of focus because some inner vision born of memory distracted him. Nostrils flared as if he had just caught the true scent of his corrupted soul. Hands no longer relaxed on the arms of the chair, but gripping the extruded aluminum as though he were aboard a roller coaster climbing to the brink of a perilous drop. By all those tells, he wrote his anxiety and his guilt as clearly as if he had composed his confession on a blackboard with a stick of chalk. Chapter 8. Before moving on to the time-consuming step of reviewing the archived video from streets flanking the alleyway, Jason Drucklow asks his girlfriend and assistant, Cammy Newton, to hurry to the site to find the phone signaling Randy Larkin's presence.
Great! On it! Cammy declares.
In these circles, the Drucklow-Newton relationship is unusual. She is only 2 years younger than he, and she holds him in the highest regard. Likewise, he is so smitten with her that sometimes he feels as if he is 13 again, full of adolescent yearning and romantic schmaltz that he once mocked in others. When they hooked up 3 years earlier, she was working as a foot technician at a nail salon, trimming and painting toenails and dealing with such issues as calluses and unpretty fungi. She feels like Cinderella, if Cinderella had been swept off her feet not by a prince, but instead by James Bond.
Gonna miss you,
she calls to him as she heads out the door, though she won't be gone an hour. Chapter 9. Hazel Sievertson lived on the edge of town, in a white Victorian with gingerbread moldings, carved pediments, and two big Italianate bay windows. The house was as frivolous as its owner was practical. Sheriff Luther Tillman climbed the steps to a highly decorated portico, unzipped his snow boots, slipped his shod feet out of them, and rang the bell. He had to ring again before Hazel appeared in woodsman's boots, gray rock climber's pants, and a blue flannel shirt with the sleeves rolled up. In spite of her outfit, she was as feminine as any object of a man's devotion, in a novel of the same period as her house.
"You took your boots off," she said. "So you're here to grill me at length. You'll have to do it without coffee in my workroom. I'm in the thrall of glass, and damn well not taking a break."
"I accept your terms, ma'am."
"Don't ma'am me. It makes me feel even older than I am."
Now 66, Hazel had retired a year earlier. After college, she served 20 years in the Army, exited as a sergeant, came home, and held the job of elementary school principal for 24 years. She'd been married 3 times. Twice to Army men, the first died in combat, the second in a helicopter crash. Her third was a scoundrel, by her determination. She divorced him after chasing him out of the house with a 12-gauge shotgun that he thought was loaded, and she reverted to her maiden name. Her workroom was an add-on at the back of the house. A 6-foot by 3-foot panel frame for a stained glass window was fixed to the central work table. She had been making windows on commission ever since she'd come home from the Army, and they could be found in homes, businesses, and churches all over the county. A full-size cartoon of the work hung on the wall, and a third of the window lay finished, a vibrant swash of reds and blues and yellows and purples.
It's abstract. It's beautiful, but you hate abstracts.
Started it yesterday. Up most of the night. It's yesterday inspired. Yesterday I decided the world is losing form, coherence. It's becoming crazy abstract. This is the new reality.
So it's about Cora.
Hell yes, it's about Cora. It's going to be beautiful, full of life. I'm titling it Cora. And if any son of a bitch objects to me hanging it in the elementary school, to hell with him.
As Hazel began selecting pre-cut shapes of glass to fit into the lead came, Luther said,
I'm not here in an official capacity.
I noticed. No uniform.
The feds have frozen my department out of this. So I'm only here as a friend. You knew Cora as well as anyone. Did she ever talk to you about a place called Iron Furnace?
Hazel looked up from her work, her expression of disgust quite like it might have been had Luther asked if Cora ever talked about Auschwitz.
That place. Something happened to her at that place.
Chapter 10. On the cool air of the empty factory, a vague odor of slime mold, here and gone, also a more pungent scent of urine, likewise inconstant. Out there in the dark beyond the lantern fall, a rustling as if a draft stirred the littered floor, yet the air dead still. Bound to his chair, Randall Larkin turned his head toward the sound, and though he clearly wondered about it, he didn't ask. Jane knew that among the great heaps of abandoned paperwork and dead files and mildewed brochures, the unwanted history of a failed enterprise had become a home to rats that clawed it and chewed it and disgorged it and shaped it into warrens. She was not yet ready to share that information with Larkin.
"What do you want from me?" he asked. "What do you think you can get that you don't already have?"
Ignoring his question, she leaned forward in her chair. You ever explore the dark web, Randy? I don't mean the deep web. There's basically nothing creepy there. The dark web. You ever visit that?
I don't know about deep webs and dark webs.
She smiled at the transparency of his lie. You can't get into the dark web with a standard search engine. Website addresses there are long chains of nonsense, letters and numbers and symbols that no one could type by accident. You can't even remember them, they're so complex. There's one particular address, 44 characters long. To get it, you have to be a member of a very exclusive club, or be given an invitation. If you type those 44 characters, Randy, you get a black screen homepage with one word. In white letters. The word is Aspasia. He closed his eyes and lowered his head as if he found her tiresome, though perhaps he was afraid to look at her just now. Then the next words are beautiful girls, totally submissive, no desire too extreme. Remember? He embraced the defense of silence. Then new words appear, she continued. Girls incapable of disobedience, permanent silence assured.
Like, cool, huh?
Costs $300,000 to join, Randy, but that's not expensive if your desires are extreme and your suits cost $4,000 and up. Only way you can join is to be invited by an existing member. As close as you seem to be to David James Michael, I assume you were one of the founding members. His strategy of non-cooperation would soon prove inadequate. Jane said, there are Aspasias in L.A., San Francisco, New York, and Washington. I've been to the one here in L.A. He opened his eyes.
That's not...
Not possible? She asked. I won't take the time to explain how I got in. It's a 3-acre walled estate, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Gosh, Randy, it's a real palace. Tens of millions must have been spent on that place. So tasteful, too, you know? Not a whiff of whorehouse about the place. Lots of super antiques, way cool Persian carpets, acres and acres of marble everywhere. Like, see, a boy could go there all horny and extreme in his desires, you know, and feel sophisticated and elite and totally okay with himself. Jane got to her feet. As she walked around behind Larkin's chair, she said, "And the girls, Randy. The girls are so stunning. I mean, they make a Victoria's Secret catalog look like a collection of has-beens and never-wases." He turned his head as best he could to look back at her. Seizing a fistful of his hair, twisting it hard, she pushed his face toward his chest. "Look at my empty chair. Don't you look anywhere but at my empty chair." He found a measure of bravado, if not real courage. "You're as good as dead." "Well, that's true of everyone, isn't it? None of us gets out of this world alive, though some get out sooner than others." She let go of his hair and patted his head with her gloved hand, as if with affection. "These totally hot girls are uber-submissive, incapable of disobedience because they've been injected with a nanomachine, a brain-tropic control mechanism. Isn't that, like, amazing sci-fi shit, Randy?" "Enough of this," he said. "You don't—" She twisted his left ear until a thin scream escaped from him. "Best be submissive," she said. "Be incapable of disobedience." She gave him a moment to collect himself. Then she said, "Yeah, really amazing sci-fi shit. And here's the coolest thing. These girls are charming and happy acting and want to please, and they never leave Aspasia. They live there all the time, because these are different implants from the ones that make people kill themselves. These implants don't just brainwash the girls. They scrub away the fabric of the mind until it's threadbare, wash out the memories, bleach out the personality and install a new one. There's no hope of bringing back who they were. It's a one-way process. Like, you know, anyone's daughter can be turned into everyone's toy, which is the coolest thing ever, don't you think?" She thought he was trembling. Hard to tell, with his hands gripping the chair so tightly. She drew one finger down the nape of his neck, and he cried out in alarm, as if he thought it must be the blade of a knife. Lowering her mouth close to the ear that she hadn't twisted, she whispered, "It's not even about sex, so much as it is about power. Isn't that right, Randy? Total power over these girls."
"I don't know," he said miserably.
"You don't know? Not really thought too deeply about it, huh?" She put her hands on his shoulders and began to massage them as if to relieve his stress. "Do you hurt the girls, Randy? Does hurting them get you off?"
"No! Hell no! It's not like that!"
"You enjoy doing things to them that would humiliate any girl not programmed like they are. You ever go a little too far and kill one of them, Randy?"
"That's crazy! Insane! There's something wrong with you!"
She worked his shoulder muscles. "Because the night I was there, I found a girl one of the guests had strangled to death. Totally submissive, see? He probably did it as he climaxed. I know it wasn't you that night, but isn't that how you'd want to time it?"
"Oh, God," he said,
faint of voice and in distress.
"Oh, God."
"You think he'd bother listening to you, Randy?
I don't think God listens to you anymore.
Anyway, I figure you sophisticates don't kill the girls routinely. I mean, that would create a major staffing problem. So it only happens now and then, when one of you is really in a master of the universe mood."
"I'm no angel, but you've got me so wrong. I'm not capable of killing anyone."
"No, you hire it done. Sakura Hanafin was allergic to hornet venom, deathly allergic, while her hubby, reporter Larry, was conveniently out of state on an assignment. Who did you hire to put those hornets in the car with Sakura Hanafin?
You can't be serious. It's just a thing happened, a natural thing. Hornets got in the car. Nobody put them there. Not every rotten thing that happens in the world is wired back to me.
She must have thought her anaphylactic kit was in the glove box, Jane said. Her epinephrine self-injectors and the liquid Benadryl. The glove box was hanging open when mall security found her dead of anaphylactic shock, a hornet sitting on her face, two others in the car. She always took the kit with her. I guess she just forgot that day. We all forget things, don't we, Randy? Chapter 11. Not 10 minutes after she dashes out of their apartment, Cammy Newton calls Jason Drucklow from behind the law offices. He rolls his chair away from the computer at which he is trying to review archived traffic cam video and turns his attention to his second workstation. On the screen, in a Google Maps version of the alley, a red dot that is Randall Larkin's locator is still blinking. Near it now is a second dot, a blue one, representing Cammy.
I've got nothing, honey. No sign of Larkin or his Mercedes. Don't see a cell phone anywhere.
You're almost on top of it, sugar. Move west a few feet. Okay. Now maybe one or two steps to your right. No, too far. Back to your left.
The two blinking signifiers bumped together.
Right there.
I'm standing on some kind of drainage grill. Or maybe a vent or something. It's got the power company name on it.
Jason said.
He dropped the phone through the grill.
Or someone did, Cammy amended.
Chapter 12. Luther Tillman already knew that Iron Furnace was a small town in Kentucky on Iron Furnace Lake. 600 residents. The biggest employer was a 100-room, 5-star, super-expensive resort. That and more he had learned online. But he didn't know why Cora Gunderson embedded those three words, apparently unconsciously, among the obsessive repetitions in her strange journal entries. After fingering a circle of red, a crescent of blue, Hazel Sievertson chose a dewdrop of yellow and fitted it into the leading.
Cora was invited to a conference at Iron Furnace Lake Resort. 4 days, 5 nights. All expenses paid. She was so excited about it.
Conference about what?
The education of special needs children. Supposed to be part conference and part reward for the attendees who'd all been at one time or another named Teacher of the Year by their city or state.
When was this?
Last August, before school began.
Who put on this conference?
A charitable foundation. I think it was something called the Seeding Foundation. No, Seedling. The Seedling Foundation.
She went to this alone?
Molding the lead came to the dewdrop curve, Hazel said.
She could have brought a guest, one girlfriend or another, which would have bollocksed things if one of the men at the conference turned out to be her Mr. Right. After all, they had a profession in common with her, an affection for children that most of the world considers lost causes. Maybe you can't quite imagine this, but Cora was a huge romantic. She believed there's someone special out there for everyone. She just needed fate to make the connection. Going to Kentucky alone was a way of giving fate a little kick in the ass.
Having read several of Cora's short stories and a portion of a novel, Luther knew she'd been a romantic who wrote about hope and the potential goodness of the human heart without sentimentality, in fact, with an undercurrent of affecting melancholy. He didn't intend, however, to tell Hazel about those notebooks, which someone had meant to incinerate, along with everything else in Cora's house.
Did she meet a man at this conference?
She met one or two she liked, but no one who, as she put it, made her want to do cartwheels.
But you said something happened to her at that place.
Hazel stopped working with the window and seemed to be studying the flow of form and color in the finished part of the composition, though it was the glass of memory through which she was peering.
I can't explain easily, Luther, but Cora was different after Iron Furnace Lake. Quieter. Less likely to laugh at silly things. I mean, the absurd things in life we all experience. She was enthusiastic about the conference when she first returned from it. But it was a gauzy kind of talk. Few specific details. Which wasn't a bit like Cora. She had a keen eye for details. When she told you about something interesting that happened, it was always a colorful story. But after a day or so, she didn't say another word about Kentucky. The few times I brought it up, she waved away the subject, as if it had been a lovely place, yes, but otherwise a disappointment.
Maybe she did meet a man there, Luther said. Someone she thought was special, and one way or another he hurt her.
Yes, I wondered, but I don't think that was it.
She left the work table and went to a window and gazed out at her mantled backyard and a grove of spruce, their glaucous needles flocked with snow and ornamented with small cylindrical cones. After decades of police work, Luther knew when a witness wanted to say something more, but felt constrained by loyalty to a friend, or by shame, or by any of the emotions and doubts that tie knots in the tongue. Techniques of interrogation failed more often than not to pry open the shell for this last pearl, and it was better to let the troubled person negotiate it with her sense of what was ethical. Without turning to face him, Hazel said,
After she came back from Kentucky, there were a few times I visited Cora and found her sitting, almost in a trance, lost in thought. Her expression, well, I can only call it haunted. I had to speak to her two or three times before she became aware of me. I felt there might be something she was afraid of, but that she didn't want to talk about.
A spider, spinning a web inside her skull, Luther thought, and laying eggs in the folds of her brain.
After another silence, Hazel said,
I should have pressed her about it. Should have been more concerned. More of a friend.
You don't have one iota of responsibility for what happened at the Veblen Hotel.
Hazel turned to face him.
I know I don't, Luther. I know.
And yet, damned if I don't feel that I do.
Chapter 13. Jane returned to her chair and pulled it closer to Randall Larkin and moved her purse beside the chair and sat so that their knees were almost touching. She smiled warmly and leaned forward and patted the attorney's left hand reassuringly.
How are you doing, Skipper?
He didn't know what to make of her. He had arrived at an inner crossroads, a bewildering intersection of rage and fear and guilt and confusion, with waning hope that he knew how to navigate from here to any kind of safety. He sat mute, without a plea, a line, a lie that seemed likely to work.
You okay? She asked again.
We have a way to go yet. I need you to be with me here.
What we need now is clear thinking, Randy. No more of the old way. No more pretense of ignorance. No evasion. No manipulation.
Although he could imagine ways that she might have learned about Aspasia, he was obviously rattled to have been nailed for being involved in the murder of Sakura Hennepin. Evidently, he didn't recall a most important thing he'd said to Lawrence Hannafin in the first of their phone conversations to which Jane had listened. When the journalist pressed to be elevated to editor of the newspaper, when he insisted he was owed some gratitude, Larkin had replied, "Only a year, and you forget what's already been done for you?" Sakura had been dead for a year. To Larkin, Jane was now more than just his tormentor, more than merely an adversary to be deceived with words or eliminated with the violence about which he had no compunction. In his confusion and helplessness, she had begun to seem to a degree magical, her sources and ways mysterious. When you were dealing with a magical creature, you could not know what trick might be played next, what spell cast, what conjuration called forth for what terrifying purpose. She said, "Officially, the firm that represents David James Michael for both his business and personal legal issues is in New York. You know the name of the firm?" He hesitated, wondering what razor blade might be hidden in that innocent question, calculating, his eyes heavily lidded like those of some ancient tribe's crocodile god. At last he said, "Forsyth, Hammersmith, Ames, and Carraway." "Very good. Excellent." She didn't know for sure that the next thing she was about to say was true, but she was capable of adding numbers greater than 2 plus 2. "If this conspiracy of yours was anything as clean and rational as the Mafia, you would be known as DJ Michael's secret consigliere, the man he really turns to for legal advice in the most crucial matters." "We're not some damn spaghetti and meatball crew," Larkin said, actually capable of snobbery even in these circumstances. "Yes, I am aware of that. Yours is an alliance of civic-minded power brokers and dazzling intellectuals unequaled in history."
"You mock it because you can't understand it."
"Whether I understand it or not, you've just confirmed you're the equivalent of DJ's secret consigliere." He opened his mouth to object, recalled his prideful spaghetti and meatballs remark, and decided to concede the point. "I want you to tell me where and how I have the best chance of getting at DJ, past his security."
"You can't."
"I want to know the weak points in his defenses."
"There are none."
"There always are."
"Not with him."
"When you think about it, you'll see I'm right." She lifted her handbag onto her lap and removed a taser, not the model that fired a dart on a wire, but one requiring the user to be within arm's reach of the target. "Know what this is, Randy?"
"Yeah." "So what?"
Being tough, being cool, not deigning to look at the device, unimpressed with the threat. "My first thought was to work you over with this. I even have 2 sets of spare batteries. You pump iron in your home gym. You have a personal trainer. You're fit, but at the core you're soft. You haven't known much pain in your pampered life. 100 or so zaps with this, I figure you'll tell me anything I want to know, rather than take another 100.
"So try me."
"I might yet." She returned the taser to the handbag. "But if possible, I'd like to spare myself the role of torturer." He straightened a little in his chair and lifted his chin, unaware that in repressing a smile of satisfaction, he had smoothed his face into a blandness so inappropriate to the moment that it was a de facto smirk. He thought she had admitted to having ethics that limited what actions she might take. "No, not that," she said, as though she could read his mind. "I want to spare myself the tedium of torture. You will resist, if only to prove that you've got at least a marginal spine. You'll resist, and you'll pass out, and I'll have to revive you, and you'll pass out again. You'll vomit and piss your pants. I'd prefer to avoid the messy intimacy of torture, considering that you'd disgust me." not even a faint smile now. From her handbag, she extracted a small Ziploc bag and showed him that it contained a frankfurter cut into 4 pieces. She opened the bag and threw the chunks of meat deeper into the factory, into different places in the gloom where paperwork had been discarded in mounds. After a wary silence, rustling suddenly arose out there in the pestilential darkness, and the thin squeaks of contestants engaged in territorial disputes, the eager busyness characterizing a species that never quite satisfied its hunger. Disturbed by scrambling feet, nests and warren ways gave forth again transient odors of urine and mold and rodent musk. The place is infested with them. Nobody's disturbed them in years. Maybe they no longer know they should be afraid of people. He turned his head to search the darkness. As the activity declined, Jane leaned forward and tapped the cable tie on Larkin's left wrist. The way this is designed, it can be pulled tighter, but it can't be loosened. It's very hard, very break-resistant plastic. You need to cut it off, and you don't have anything to cut with. He found the will to remain expressionless. From her handbag, she extracted a fat roll of gauze, a gag to shove in your mouth. She produced a roll of duct tape to wind around your head a few times to secure the gag. She returned them to the handbag. You see the dog bowls on the table? His gaze went to the bowls. I'll put them on the floor near the places where they're nesting in all the trash. The 4 bottles of water are for the bowls. To get a drink, the poor things have to scurry all the way down into the basement, where water collects after a rain. But it's nasty, dirty, stagnant water. They'll like a taste of something fresh. But it's not just water. Larkin's attention had shifted to her. His body, his face, his khaki-brown eyes were as steady as if time had stopped, as if he sat now as part of a tableau on which the laws of physics no longer had any effect in a stilled universe. Its water spiked with a concentration of an over-the-counter appetite stimulant that used to be available by prescription only. Cancer patients and others with no desire to eat find it highly effective. When the pharmaceutical company was developing this stuff, they tested it on lab rats. The little guys were positively ravenous. It takes 2 hours after they have a drink, especially at the concentration I've provided. That'll be an interesting 2 hours for you. Shouldn't be a boring moment in it. Had the day been hot, there would have been some doubt. But the day was mild, the factory cool, and the emergence of 1,000 tiny droplets across the width of Larkin's paste-pale brow could have but one interpretation. He arrived at the only conclusion that he could allow himself.
You'd never do it. You never would. Not this. It's inhuman.
Jane was surprised by her own laughter, genuine, but so dark that it disturbed her. Oh, honey, you really are quite a prize. You people strip away the minds of innocent girls, their memories and hopes, and you program them for hideous serial abuse. You turn those with whom you don't agree into suicide machines based on some idiot computer model. You threaten to rape and kill 5-year-old boys, my 5-year-old boy. And you think you have the right to judge me inhuman? She half rose from her chair and leaned over him. He tried to pull away, sure that she had violence in mind. But she only pinched his cheek, not hard, but as if with perverse affection. Randy, I can't even begin to compete with you in a game of inhumanity. You have so much to teach and nothing to learn about the subject. She sat once more and wiped her eyes as if the tears were those of only laughter. The Coleman lantern hissed softly, and tiny muffled voices spoke of an unexpected banquet, their wordless sounds as thin as the creaking floorboards under the weight of a stalker in a dream. Leaning toward Larkin, she said, I've been on the run more than 2 months. I'm on the most wanted list of every police agency in the country. I couldn't begin to count the number of people who would shoot me on sight if they had the chance. I'm as desperate gets, Randy. If you don't tell me how I can get to David James Michael and take him down, I'll leave you to the rats and know that the only person who'd disapprove would be the devil himself, because he wants you alive to do his work. Chapter 14. Jason Drucklow threw a back door into the nearly infinite vaults of the NSA, a chambered sea flooded with archived phone calls and text messages and emails and video from uncounted sources. Like a scuba diver, swimming down through murky strata, past coral reefs of secrets big and small, a treasure of submerged wonders to be explored, perhaps the very truth of creation waiting below in one watery abyss or another. Though at the moment, seeking only ordinary traffic cam video. The first of the two pertinent street cameras, beyond the east end of the alleyway, which should have captured Larkin arriving at his office building, is apparently malfunctioning. It currently offers no real-time image of Beverly Hills in all its legendary elegance, only a blank screen. When Jason sources the archived video, he first specifies 7 o'clock a.m. of this same day, and then 6:30, and then 6 o'clock. But the camera continues to offer nothing. Only when he jumps all the way to 5 o'clock a.m. is he rewarded with a view of the street from north to south. Dawn, still perhaps an hour in the future. The lamplit avenue quiet in the last of the night. A street-sweeping truck swirling out a thin, low sluice of water, whirling it away with whatever dead leaves and litter. A delivery van headed south to north. A police car on patrol from north to south. Jason fast-forwards to the sudden appearance of a pedestrian at 5:11, when a flare of light is followed by a blank screen. He scans backward to the moment when the figure emerges from the mouth of the alley, then plays the video at normal speed. Lamplight offers far less clarity than the sun, but Jason is certain this is a woman who approaches. She raises both arms, and only at the muzzle flash does he realize she holds a firearm in a two-hand grip. The screen goes blank the instant after the flash. She's a superb marksman. Jason keeps up with current events, and he realizes who she must be. He sources the traffic cam on the avenue past the west end of the alley, and soon discovers that she blew out this camera, again, with one shot, less than 3 minutes before she wrecked the one on the parallel street to the east. The light, this time, is marginally better, and the extreme length of the pistol barrel suggests it is fitted with a sound suppressor. There will be no video of Randall Larkin arriving at the east end of the alleyway in his Mercedes, or leaving at the west end. The likelihood is that he was kidnapped and driven away by Jane Hawk. Jason is excited that a chase is on, the woman on the run and the hunter in pursuit, from the comfort of his apartment. He has no doubt that he will find the Mercedes soon, the kidnapper and the kidnapped soon thereafter. Chapter 15. As if it were a magical elixir, the water glimmered with gas lantern light, and the facets of the plastic bottles shone as crisp as beveled crystal. Jane picked up one of the 4 bottles from the makeshift table and took it to Randall Larkin in his patio chair. Twisting off the cap, she said, I want you to drink half of this. The ghastly aspect of his fear-fevered eyes, his pallor, and his sheen of sweat proved well enough that he no longer believed in his invincibility, but he couldn't give up the pretense that he remained one of a sovereign class above all harm. With feigned indifference, he said, "I'm not thirsty." "What does that have to do with anything?"
"I won't drink it. There's that stuff in it."
"That's exactly why you will drink it, Randy. I want you to feel the effectiveness of this appetite stimulant in such a high concentration, so you'll know how crazy hungry the rats will be."
"You can't make me."
"Don't be pathetic. Here's your choice. You be nice and drink half a bottle when I hold it for you, or I zap you with the taser, you cry out, I jam the bottle in your open mouth and clamp your jaw shut and pour it straight down, so you either have to swallow fast or drown. Your situation is already unpleasant, counselor. Why make it worse?" She held the bottle for him, pouring slowly, and he swallowed rhythmically. Half the contents made it down his throat, merely a dribble or two wetting his chin. She capped the bottle and put it with the other three. Once more in her chair, knees almost touching Larkin's knees, this intimacy unnerving him, Jane said, "D.J. Michael owns an estate in Palo Alto, an apartment in San Francisco, a 3-acre estate on Lake Tahoe in Nevada, another apartment in New York, maybe more homes I don't know about. I want you to tell me certain particulars of each place, the layout, the way the security works. I have a list."
"There's no way you can get at him."
"I don't expect you to tell me where you think there might be vulnerabilities. You won't know anyway. Knowing these things isn't who you are. It's who I am. Tell me enough, and I'll see where the holes in the fence are." While Jane took a notebook and pen from her handbag, Larkin at last climbed down fast from his imagined throne on Olympus, pulling about himself a beggar's cloak of self-pity, eyes misting with grief for his lost status.
"I tell you or I don't tell you. I'm dead."
"You're right about the second choice. But when this is over, you go back and lie about what you told me. You're a hero, right? You gave me nothing but misinformation, and then you escaped." He shivered now, though the factory was actually warmer than it had first been.
"You don't know these people. These people are out to change the world, with them higher at the top of the heap than anyone has ever been or dreamed of being. With so much at risk, everything. They'll pop me, plant me, and piss on my grave."
Spittle flew with each plosive.
"They know how you are, and they know me, and that's the end of trust. I'll be garbage to them now. These people don't know for mercy."
"These people? Randy, listen to yourself. You are one of these people."
"Not after this."
Barely repressed, hot tears burned his eyes red, but maybe his sweat was as cold as it was sour. Off him came a smell like salted meat gone bad. He was too inept an actor to fake this collapse of confidence. As lamentable as a car-struck dog, he squinted up at the high, dirty windows as if no glimpse of a sun unfiltered would be his again. And then he closed his eyes and hung his head and trembled in his bonds. Despairing, he was no good to her. She had pushed him harder than he could withstand, and now she needed to provide him with a fragile hope. Fragile because he wouldn't believe any certain promise of safe passage. "I can give you a way out. You're not going to be a nano king, doing whatever you want to the submissive girls of Aspasia, a world of slaves at your bidding. But there is a way to have a life." After a long moment, he looked up.
"What way?"
"If I tell you now, if you see the path out of where you are, you'll start playing me again. I won't get what I need from you. The only way it works is you tell me about DJ Michael, and when we're done, if I believe every word you've said, you get what you want." She opened her notebook, clicked the ballpoint pen. When she asked about DJ's Palo Alto house, Larkin answered her questions. and what he said sounded true enough. As for the apartment in San Francisco, which occupied the entire 9th floor of a 10-story building that was owned by DJ, Larkin said,
"It's his ultimate redoubt. He feels safest there. As well he should. No one will ever get at him in that building. You try for him there, you'll be maggot food in short order."
When he explained what awaited any intruder in that place, Jane knew for certain that he was telling the truth, because he was not a man of sufficient imaginative power to invent such a horror.